The Sunstone Foundation presents On Criticizing the Authorities, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University Park Hotel, where the program is about to begin.
They are pretty bright, aren't they? Well, a lot brighter than I am tonight, I'll tell you that. Now, this is a talk on criticizing the brethren, so here goes. It's nice to be here and all that. Take that for granted, and let's start. The time is short. After indulging in the usual overkill in lining up the sources for this ordeal, I decided to let Joseph Smith do most of the talking. After all, the criticism of the church and its leaders has always centered around him. It began before the church was founded, and to this day he's still the main subject of attack. The astonishing fulfillment of Moroni's prophecy to a country kid living out in the backwoods, that his name would be known for good and evil among men everywhere, is enough in itself to prove that Joseph Smith was a true prophet. Critics attacking the church still assail Joseph Smith with a sort of private vindictiveness, as if he personally were responsible for their own woes and frustrations. Remember, great contempt he met with from the minister when he was between 14 and 15 years old, a report of his first vision, and then he says that it excited a great deal of prejudice against me among professors of religion and was the cause of great persecution. That was from between 14 and 15 years old. He knew about criticism. Why this passionate and relentless attacks on Joseph Smith, and why do they continue to this day? It was because of the uncompromising position he took, the mind frame of one who, after a glimpse into yonder heavens, once for all, took the measure of the world. And he was still a child, he said. My mind became exceedingly distressed when he viewed the yawning gulf between the world of which God had given men, as he says, the earth also upon which I stood, and the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heavens, and the fish of the waters, and man also walking forth on the face of the earth in majesty and in strength and beauty, and so forth. And compares that with the shambles which men have made of it, the contentions and the divisions and the wickedness and abominations and darkness which pervaded the minds of mankind, and I felt to mourn for my own sins and the sins of the world. He saw that gulf ever widening, and the revelations, got to get these right. I behold, he said, the manifest withdrawal of God's Holy Spirit and the veil of stupidity which seems to be drawn over the hearts of people. Mankind will persist in their self-justification until all their iniquity is exposed. When he first tried to tell his story, remember, he found all communication had been severed by the ministry. My soul was filled with love. This is his whole story, actually. My soul was filled with love, and for many days I could rejoice with a great joy, for the Lord was with me, but I could find none who would believe in the heavenly vision. As one tutored from above, he reached the conclusion, the opinions of men, so far as I am concerned, are to me the crackling of thorns under the pot or the whistling of the wind. What he had done was to reintroduce a new dimension into the world, or rather, as Edward Meyer so impressively sets forth, he reintroduced the very same universe of discourse which had existed in the days of the apostles and prophets. It was no mere rhetoric when he said, "No man knows my history. If I had not experienced what I have, I could not believe it myself." Have we increased in knowledge? I put this in here, inserted, because it's a beautiful picture today. In knowledge or intelligence, our nation, which possesses greater resources than any other, is rent from center to circumference with party strife, political intrigues and sectional interests. Our tradesmen are disheartened, our mechanics out of employ, our farmers distressed, and our poor crying for bread. Our banks are broken, our credit ruined. What is the matter? Are we alone in this thing? Verily, no. The world itself presents one great theater of misery and woe, and the distress of nations with perplexity. All speak with a voice of thunder that man is not able to govern himself, to legislate for himself, to protect himself, to promote his own good, nor the good of the world. It was not a speculative religion that Joseph brought. Like John, he spoke only of what he had seen with his eyes, heard with his ears, and felt with his hands. In contrast to that, the whole Christian doctrine, as Brigham Young put it, simmered down into a snuff box. But when I found Mormonism, it was higher than I could reach, deeper than I could comprehend, calculated to expand the mind from truth to truth, from light to light, to become associated with the gods and angels. In 1831, the conference voted, Joseph reports, that the riches of eternity, the Book of Mormon and the Revelations, are worth the riches of the whole earth. In short, as Joseph Smith as Joseph Smith put it, the difference between the saints and the world is that the saints know and the world does not. Now, to say the least, that attitude is going to invite criticism. The word criticism is from krino, split down the vision, down the middle, divide. Discerno, you see, distinguish between two things, exactly like the Latin interlegere, to make a choice between two things, usually two things, between interlegere, to select between things, usually two things, namely the power to distinguish or judge between two or more things. The binary process, you might, bayana, the Semitic story, bayana, to split in the middle, and the one or the other. And it may be surprising that the critics from the beginning to the present did not attack Joseph Smith on moral grounds. That would have been counterproductive. Naughty boys were a dime a dozen, and scandal mongering works both ways. The stock phrases from Hurlburt to Howe, Hurlburt and Howe down to Brodie, were lazy, indolent, money-digging, superstitious. No, the specific attacks on the super-offender were all, and still are, all on intellectual grounds. Remember, too, it's only fair because he saw them behind a veil of stupidity. Webster defines criticism as the art of judging with knowledge and propriety of the beauties and faults of works of art or literature, of moral values to the soundness of scientific hypotheses and procedures, etc. Notice, with knowledge and propriety, the critics necessarily assume the intellectual and moral superiority to the thing they're criticizing. As Aristotle says, the observer feels superior to the observed, even when the observer is the cat and the observed is the king. Since Joseph frankly stated that because of his family's indigence, he was denied advantages of an education, the critics have rejoiced to find themselves holding all the hand, all the cards, under no obligation to pay serious attention to anything as ignorant that ignorant farmer might say. To this day, they have worked their alleged intellectual advantage for all it was worth. Critics within the church have done the same thing. They still take the position of high academic advantage. Therefore, there were always those among the brethren themselves who resented Joseph Smith's towering ascendancy in view of his limited education, tried to bring him down with terrible affidavits, which they later admitted were false. The first elders of the church, said Brigham, decided that Joseph did not understand temporal matters. The first bishops of the church said they believed with all their hearts that they understood the temporal matters far better than the prophet Joseph. I have seen men belonging to this kingdom who really thought that if they were not associated with it, it could not progress. So the critics magnanimously volunteer their superior intellect powers and put them at the disposal of the church and so forth. This brings us to a fundamental issue. The prophet's advantage over the world lay in revelation, of course. But in the church, every follower has an equal right to revelation. Now, how could he stand up and be the leader when everyone could have his own claim to revelation? They immediately started doing it as soon as they joined the church. It was he himself who insisted most emphatically on everyone's right to inspiration. Search the scriptures, he says. Ask your Heavenly Father in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, to manifest the truth unto you. You will then know for yourself and not for another. You will not then depend on man for knowledge of God, nor will there be any room for speculation. Now, this is a point upon which the prophet Joseph himself placed the greatest emphasis. There is no office or calling in the church which qualifies its holder as an official interpreter of the scriptures. That's the prerogative of conventional priest or minister who has been to college and studied for the ministry. But the boast of the Latter-day Saints is that they have no professional clergy, even in matters of doctrine. Joseph says, this is the privilege of every elder to speak for the things of God. The Lord has declared that people should every man stand for himself and depend on no man or woman. He said if the people departed from the Lord, they must fall, that they were dependent on the prophet and hence were darkening their minds in consequence of neglecting the duties devolving upon themselves. The people should each one stand for himself, another quotation from Joseph Smith, and depend not on man or men, that righteous persons could only deliver their own souls. Fellow sojourners on earth, it is your privilege to purify yourselves and come up to the same glory and see for yourselves and know for yourselves. Ask and it shall be given unto you. Recall that what started Joseph's feet on this path was the statement in James, let him ask of God, who giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not. He won't rebuke you for asking. God hath not revealed anything to Joseph, he said, but he will make it known unto the 12, and even the least saint may know all things as fast as he is able to bear them here. For the day must come when no man need say to his neighbor, Know ye the Lord, for all shall know him from the least to the greatest. How is this to be done? It's to be done by the sealing power and the other comforter spoken of, which would be manifest by the revelations. Well, wouldn't that sort of thing not lead people to all sorts of confusion, all kinds of crazy ideas and the like? Well, of course it did. It did right from the first. We have crazy ideas, but we don't preach them. Joseph says, you do that. Now listen what he said when old Brother Brown was brought up before the High Council. Joseph, no, I never thought it was right to call up a man and try him because he erred in doctrine. It looks too much like Methodism and is not like Latter-day Saintism. Methodists have a creed which a man must believe or be kicked out of their church. I want the liberty to believe as I please. It feels good not to be trammeled. It doesn't prove that a man is not a good man because he errs in doctrine. The High Council undertook to censor and correct Brother Brown because of his teachings in relation to the beasts in Revelations. And he came to me to know what he should do about it. Joseph Smith said his teachings were absolutely ridiculous. He says, I could not keep from laughing at the ideas he had, but he had a right to them. And then he says, the elders shouldn't attack me for that. He says, I qualify my declaration, which I'm about to make, so that the young elders who know so much may not rise up and choke me like hornets. The elders like to dictate doctrine to each other. And he didn't reserve even the mysteries to himself. He says, there is no salvation in believing evil reports against our neighbors. Instead of criticizing, I advise all to go on to perfection and search deeper and deeper into the mysteries of godliness. It has been my province to dig up hidden mysteries, new things for my hearers, etc. I never hear of a man being damned for believing too much, but they are damned for unbelief. Always bearing in mind that a mystery is, by definition, something you keep to yourself. Me always means to shut up. A mystery is something you've been initiated into and that you don't convey to the public or the general. You don't convey to anyone but yourself. So keep the mysteries. He says, we deem it a just principle that all men are created equal and that all have the privilege of thinking for themselves upon all matters relating to conscience. Consequently, we are not disposed, had we the power, to deprive anyone of exercising that free independence of mind which heaven has so graciously bestowed upon the human family as one of his choicest gifts. If other blessings are not your blessings, others' curses are not your curses. You stand agents unto yourselves to be judged according to your works, every man for himself. And this applies in politics and everything else. I have not come to tell you to vote this way, that way, or the other in relation to national matters. I wanted to go abroad to the whole world, that every man should stand on his own merits. The Lord has not given me revelation concerning politics. I have not asked the Lord for it. I am a third party and stand independent and alone. I desire to see all parties protected under the law. I utterly forbid these political demagogues from using my name hereafter forever, because they were doing it, you see. If 10,000, well, into the majesty of the American people, the vote, he says, if 10,000 men testify to a truth, you know, would it add to your faith? No. Nor will a thousand testimonies destroy your knowledge of a fact? No. I do not want anyone to tell that I am a prophet or attempt to prove my word. Quite strong on that. He says, with regard to elections, some say we all vote together, as I say. But I never tell any man how to vote or who to vote for. Joseph Duncan said if the people would elect him, he would exterminate the Mormons and take away their charters. As to Mr. Ford, he made no such threats. Well, then, in such a uniquely clear-cut case, open and shut, there was no need for Joseph or anybody else to give advice. And in all other cases, Joseph absolutely refused to. And so he writes to the editor of the Wasp. He says, my feelings revolt at the idea of having anything to do with politics. I have declined in every instance to have anything to do with the subject. I think it would be well for politicians to regulate their own affairs. I wish to be let alone that I may attend strictly to the spiritual welfare of the church. You see, that was another arena. That was another ball game, another area of experience and power, having nothing to do with the eternities. And for Joseph, it was a distraction he was pushed into. He did not like it. But government was never by compulsion, even in the church. No man is being forced against his will. There is common agreement. He says, people acting together are the foundation of the authority of the church. I informed the people that in the government of the church, in business transactions, every man should have a voice in the matter as if the whole responsibility were on his shoulders. When everyone shall see for themselves and prophesy for themselves and have vision for themselves, only then will they have undivided feelings and be able to dispense with present teachers, because they'll all have the same visions then, but for themselves. But even when they act with such perfect unity, every man must act according to the wisdom he can command. No man can be condemned for voting in the negative, Joseph. This newfound freedom was bound to go to the heads of some people, you can see that. Until they became Mormons, they never dreamed of such a prospect for advancement. Pioneer types were always looking for the big break, the bonanza. New members of the church almost overnight would start having dreams of personal glory and claiming authority of personal revelation. When Brother Joseph put restraints on their claims and their plans, they would often declare him a fallen prophet and offer their own revelation as the way to go. A surprising number of people do that sort of thing today, follow that course. You would think that this would put the church at a terrible risk. In fact, it would have destroyed any man-made organization many times, and indeed the score of defectors have loudly proclaimed that their newly discovered evidence and powerful arguments would once for all bring Mormonism down in ruins. Hurlburt and his disciple Brody made that very same boast. When the great theologian Christer Stendahl was here, was in Provo, he's now Bishop of Lund, as you know, of the Lutheran Church. Some years ago, I had a conversation with him, and he was very much upset. He did not like at all Joseph Smith's statement, no man was ever damned for believing too much. But if you're damned for believing too much, we're all damned. For all of us believe things that aren't true, things that will be proven false in time to come, and so forth. And the list of scientists we have here, Galileo, Newton, Heisenberg, Planck, Hawking, Penrose, Hoyle, you have them, all have differing beliefs about the very nature of our existence, the most fundamental doctrines of reality. Remember, Einstein used to bring God into it, but they all respected each other and they didn't damn each other for wrong ideas. Yet throughout history, men have damned and persecuted and banished and imprisoned and burned others on a vast scale, not for any crimes they committed, purely for having the wrong ideas. The only crime for the Inquisition was heresy. Joseph says, if a man is authorized to take away my life because I say, who say I'm a false teacher, so should I have the same right as to all false teachers. And then where would be the end of the blood? There's no law in the heart of God to allow anyone to interfere with the rights of man. Every man has the right, this is a great saying, every man has the right to be a false as well as a true prophet. If I show verily that I have the truth of God and show that 99 of 100 are false prophets, it would deluge the whole world with blood, and that's exactly what it has done. Consider the Christians and Muslims of Lebanon, for example, living together for centuries with each other, sharing the same customs and values. Each knows the other not as a bad person, yet for months they've been slaughtering each other purely for having the wrong beliefs. And within the groups, the Sunni and the Shiites are both good Muslims, who disagree on but one point of tradition, and for that, the car bombs and artillery fire have reduced their beautiful city to rubble. How does one deal with unbelievers, critics, and heretics? Joseph Smith wrote the book on that, the Book of Mormon, all set forth in exceeding plainness. In the reign of King Mosiah, after the time of prosperity, a rising generation, we're told, quote, this is the 26th chapter of Mosiah, could not understand the words of King Benjamin. The resurrection, especially, they found incomprehensible and unbelievable, as most Christians have, because they would not make an effort to believe it. They could not understand, and so their hearts were hardened. They used that as an excuse, of course, for escaping from the moral restraints of their behavior that the gospel required. They adopted their own lifestyle, and we're quoting, and they were a separate people as to their faith. They embraced a much more permissive moral doctrine, which became very popular, the religion of the Nehors. The popularity of that easygoing church made it the dominant religion, almost to the end of the Book of Mormon. No wonder, since it allowed them, as we're told, to live in a carnal and sinful state. The numbers of dissenters grew due to criticism within the church, the dissensions among the brethren, while the outsiders kept working on the members to accept the new moral emancipation. All this is in the first six verses of the 26th chapter. Excuse me. What was to be done? Members of the church who had begun to make trouble were brought before local priests and teachers by local members, but those officers didn't know what to do except to send the culprits on to Alma, who was the high priest, we're taught. Next verse 7. Since Mosiah recognized Alma as the head of the state, he felt it should be his problem, but Alma didn't know what to do either. In fact, he had no idea what had been going on. That's very interesting. All this up... Alma, the head of the church, hadn't heard of it at all. He's the only one who didn't know. Well, no, that's something. Couldn't he be criticized for that? Well, remember, Moroni criticized Pahoran unfairly because he didn't know the score, and he didn't know the score because Pahoran hadn't told him that. He kept back the bad news lest it discourage the soldiers at the front. Who is to blame in a case like that? As to the new subversives, Alma, we're told, was troubled in his spirit, and he referred the matter back to the king. The 11th verse. The immoral conduct of certain members of the church was confirmed and admitted by them. They had no intention of repenting. Civil law could punish them only according to their crimes, is a quote. But this disruption of the church and society, making sport of people's belief, couldn't that be punished? Mosiah wanted to wash his hands of it. He said, "Behold, I judge them not," he says. And he tossed the hot potato right back to Alma. "I deliver them into thy hands to be judged." And Alma was helpless. And he was perplexed, and he inquired of the Lord. And the answer was clear and explicit. "He that will not hear my voice, the same shall not, he shall not receive into my church." Excommunication was the limit of their authority and the only power to punish the church has ever had. It is not the same power of excommunication claimed by the Roman Church, where excommunication meant the same as damnation. It's for one alone to judge and pronounce a sentence of eternal salvation or damnation, and that when the time comes, as the Lord told the disciples at Capernaum. But after being cut off from the church, the Lord told Alma, any who confessed and repented were to be forgiven out of hand, even as often as they repented, it tells us. And after that, they were not to be judged or criticized by other members of the church for what they had done. Then something much worse happened. Alma's eldest son and four of Mosiah's sons rebelled. One gets the feeling that Alma had been perhaps too strict. Extreme severity with youth doesn't go over well in prosperous times. As a leading light among the young, like Alcibiades or the Algonquin crowd when I was young, the younger Alma, an impressive and persuasive personality, as we learned from his later career, became all the rage with the youth, making fun of the beliefs, liberating them from the old-fashioned ways of their parents. And with their public showing off, they mixed private parties and conclaves, deliberately seeking to break down the church and the government. We're told that all in the 10th verse here. We know Joseph had this all figured out. That's a clever kid, don't you think, at 23, no education at all. We know that it took an angel to stop them, but their fathers were the head of the church and the monarch himself. Why didn't they do more? Why didn't they simply lock up the troublemakers till they learned to behave? It was because the young protesters were making a religious statement, however offensive and negative. The king had laid down the law, and we quote again, no persecution either of believers by non-believers, by believers, or of believers by other believers, or by unbelievers by other unbelievers. In short, there was to be no persecution, period. And the purpose of all this, we are told in the beginning of the 27th chapter, was that there should be an equality among all men. Where one group can bring social pressure on another, you do not have equality. Just imagine the king and the high priest both allowing criticism, dissension, propagandizing to go on and on, doing nothing about it until the lax and easy church of the dissenters became the knee-whores and began taking over everything. The fact that the young men, they far outnumbered the regular church before long. The fact that the young men behaved so insolently certainly suggests they'd been either somewhat spoiled or over-disciplined or neglected. Remember, Alma didn't know what was going on. Nevertheless, obnoxious as they made themselves, they were within their rights. They were making a religious statement, and no one could deny them that privilege. Why not? We're quoting again from Alma 30. Because it was strictly contrary to the commandments of God to have any law against a man's belief. Belief including atheism, whose believers are often as fervid as any fundamentalists. If the man, we're told in Alma, if a man desired to serve God, it was his privilege. But if he did not believe in him, there was no law to punish him. It was under the protection of this Bill of Rights that the infamous Korihor was able to carry on with perfect impunity. It was only a miracle that stopped him. The only punishment that he received was at the hands of a Zoramite mob when he had left the country. Korihor had been brought before Ammon, the high priest at Jerushan, who passed him on to Gedonah, the high priest in the land of Gideon, who sent him on to Alma at Zarahemla. Were all those leading authorities so helpless? Yes, against the right of free speech and freedom of religion laid down by the commandments of God. That's the words of the Book of Mormon. There was punishment for crimes, of course, and it lists the crimes. Nevertheless, there was no law against a man's belief. Therefore, all men were on equal grounds. No one was subject to any social pressure or group disapproval. If he didn't want to participate in public prayer, for example, or if he agreed with Isaiah that such displays of piety are usually an abomination before God, or that only God is in a position, as Isaiah again, to say which nations are really under God and which are not. But what have we got here? Oh, we'll more about Korihor and stuff. We won't go into that. But I am going to insert here a quotation from a recent news dispatch, not recent, a couple of years ago. You remember this, Charlottesville, Virginia. The National Council of Boy Scouts of America has backed up local Scout officials and ruled that a youth who does not believe in God must be expelled from the organization, says the local Scout leader. Paul Trout, 15, was denied a Life Scout promotion several months ago when he said he didn't believe in a supreme being, and now will be forced to leave the organization following the ruling by the National Scout leaders, Hunter said Friday, unquote. Quoting back the law of the Nephites again, if he did not believe, there was no law to punish him. Therefore, all men were on equal grounds. No one will deny that the smart aleck criticism of Alma and his friends was bad, unfair, foolish, and injurious. What could be done about it? Something here. Maybe it goes there. Well, the answer was the same. You reply by preaching the gospel with increased fervor, and that's what the young Alma learned for himself. Let's get some something. Here's some quotations of good ones now. Don't you wish you had some power to pinch their ears? Do you not wish you had power to stop them in their mad career? Let the Lord Almighty do this. You think his eyes are not upon the work of his hands? It is. His ears are open to the prayers of his children. He will hear their prayers. He will answer their desires. And when we as a people possess the abundance of that patience, that long-suffering and forbearance that we need to possess the privilege and power the Lord has reserved for his people, he will receive it. We will receive it to our utmost satisfaction. We shall not have it now. The Lord says, I cannot give it now. We are not tolerant enough. Now suppose that we were to issue our edicts to the whole world of mankind for them to obey the gospel we preach and had the power to compel them to obey. Could we do it according to the dictates of our religion? We could not, of course. We could invite them. We could tell them how. But we could not say and maintain the faith that we have embraced, you must bow down and profess our religion and submit to the ordinances of the kingdom of God. Well, but there is a principle as strong as that of free agency itself, and it exists from eternity to eternity, we read in the third chapter of Abraham. And that principle is that there is a head. There must always be a head. In the spirit of my calling, and in view of the authority of the priesthood which has been conferred upon me, it would be my duty to reprove whatever I esteem to be wrong. Joseph did not hesitate to cut off the highest authorities in that capacity. Would any impostor have dared to excommunicate such powerful and ambitious men as William E. McClellan, Thomas B. Marsh, D.W. Patton, W.W. Phelps, John Whitmer, Orson Hyde, and so forth, men who knew all about his own personal affairs, if there had been any serious transgression in his own past? He says, we do not feel bound to receive any revelation from any man or woman everybody has a perfect right to revelation, all he wants, but we do not feel bound to receive any revelation from any man or woman without his being legally constituted and ordained to that authority and giving sufficient proof of it. Many should take this to heart today. Many's the character I've come up to be and say to me, Brother Nibley, the Lord has revealed to me that you should give me an A. Well, all I have to say, we do not feel bound by any such revelation. No member of the church has any right, this is Joseph again, no member of the church has any right to publish any doctrine as doctrines of the church. Notice to publish. You can have all the ideas you want. Publish, that's a different thing, as doctrines of the church, without first submitting it to the leaders for their approval. This does not cramp anyone's style. Any person, says Joseph Smith again, these are all from Joseph, can ask the Lord for a witness concerning himself and get an answer, but not to lead the church. That belongs to the head of the church. This doesn't make a tyrant of the leader. The keys of the priesthood were committed to Joseph to build up the kingdom. But when he was called to preside over the church, it was by the voice of the people. That's Joseph again. The leaders are not to be blindly followed. This is strong stuff now. Suppose the people threw the whole burden of the leader, of the leaders upon the people, upon the prophet, saying, if the brethren who take charge are satisfied, we are satisfied. This is not pleasing in the sight of the Lord. This is not pleasing. Nothing is automatic here. Always the Spirit must lead. Of recent years, one frequently hears, especially in testimony meetings, that we are thankful for having a prophet who can tell us exactly what we have to do and think every moment of the day. The prophet has a convenient time and trouble safer. Actually, people pester him to death for these things. They always have. As someone ready to bail you out, no matter what silly things you've done or what a fool you've made of yourself, well, you're not going to learn anything that way. Let us recall Joseph's warning. The people were depending on the prophet, hence darkening their minds, neglecting the duties evolving upon themselves. As the prophet, he was not to be called on in every emergency. He says, it is a great thing to inquire at the hands of God, and we feel fearful to approach him, especially about things the knowledge of which men should obtain in all sincerity for themselves by humility and prayer. Don't ask me for a revelation. You have just as much right to it, he says. Joseph was not told everything. He said the three things he wanted to know more than anything else were withheld from him. And he said, regarding the Missouri affair, I dare not advise, not knowing what shall befall us, as we are under very heavy, serious threatenings from a great many people in this place. Do the people believe Joseph Smith, Jr. to be a prophet? Yes, and every man who has a testimony of Jesus. When Brigham Young was asked, this is an interview with a newspaper, I think it's New York Herald, do you, like the prophets of old, receive direct revelation from God? He answered, yes, and my brethren also. Does that extend to all the church without reserve or rank? Yes, it is just as necessary for the mother to possess this spirit in training and rearing her children as for anyone else. Is it not necessary for each person to receive revelation through you? Oh, no, through the Spirit of Christ, the Holy Ghost, but to dictate to the church is my part. In the same way, what the brethren say, 84th section, is the word of the Lord, the will of the Lord, and so forth, but only, as President Clark pointed out, no less than 27 times in a speech on the subject, when they are so moved upon by the Holy Ghost. But how can we know that, writes Brother Clark? By following the oft-repeated principle that everyone must so live, the Holy Ghost will reveal to him whether the others are speaking by the Spirit or not. Do you know whether I am leading you right or not? Do you know whether I dictate to you right or not? Do you know whether the wisdom of the mind of the Lord are dispensed to you or not? I have a request to make of each and every Latter-day Saint, of those who profess to be, to live by the Spirit of the Lord, to it will whisper to them and teach them the truth. In this there is safety. Without this there is danger, imminent danger. You'd get a tyrant otherwise, you're a dictator. And my exhortation to Latter-day Saints is live your religion, and you'll know for yourself. Now, does this put us in the position of critics then? Yes. Critics of our own behavior. Before I question another or make a direct appeal to God, I must be perfectly sure of my own purity and integrity. And that amounts, well, because what I'm asking for is the same revelation, as a matter of fact, for myself. So there's where the criticism, you start out with real criticism here. And here now. Now, no one knew better than Joseph Smith the weakness. What about this here? Well, yes, it didn't break down some things here. Well, we get the paradox. With all this freedom of the individual in society, there is a... Well, the first check on criticism is this. Be not so certain that you comprehend the things of God when all things with you are so uncircled. Every one of these things are gems, uncertain. That's the first step. You don't know so damn much. You don't know anything as far as that goes. That is true. This is something to each other, reported from the New York Herald, seeing Brigham Young at the dance was bemused. He said he couldn't get away with it. Such familiarity would in most cases be fatal to great claims. Strange world, strange people. And again, he says, wonderful man, Brigham. No other man dares to speak to such men as he does. Yet they take it in good part, wince under it at the time, but once chastened, they're even more devoted than ever, if possible. And he says, yes, people should be preached. Now, he's talking about the brethren. He says, most of the elders who preach in this stand ought to be kicked out of it and then kicked into it again until they overhaul themselves and find out what's the matter with them. Now that's criticism, but it's constructive criticism. He wants them kicked back again. So we get this paradox. Interestingly, in the line of physical science today, of course, we can't be certain about anything. We live in a wicked world where men busy themselves watching for iniquity, Joseph says. What is to be gained by it? The spirits of good men cannot interfere with the wicked beyond their prescribed grounds. For Michael said, Michael the archangel dared not bring railing accusation against the devil, but said, the Lord rebuke thee, Satan. Here's an interesting passage. Well, the time is wasting, but an individual with an abhorrent, this is a characteristic situation that was so familiar. This is in the year that the prophet was martyred. An individual with an abundance of with an abhorrence of evil joins the church. He sets himself up upon watch to detect the failing of others, deeming that he is doing God a service by being so employed. And thus, he is decoyed into the occupation of the great master of evil to be the accuser of his brethren. And during the time thus occupied, he considers himself actuated by the purest motives arising from a detestation of sin. Yet mark the subtlety of Satan in leading men into such a false position. Such a course, in the first place, probably arose from the purest of motives, and perhaps the individual was instrumental in rectifying some error. He feels satisfied for having done so, and his self-esteem is gratified. And ere he is aware, he is seeking for another opportunity of doing the same, continually setting himself up as being capable of sitting in judgment upon others and of rectifying by his own ability the affairs of the kingdom. Joseph says, the eagerness to accuse is from the devil. But Joseph recognizes at all times the defects of the church, and they're the same we find today. He says, that's not the point. He says, notwithstanding this congregation profess to be saints, yet I stand in the midst of all characters and classes of man. Yes, I am standing in the midst of all kinds of people. Search your hearts and see if you're like God. I have searched my... Now, this is from... I'm going to say foul mouth book. That new book that is being... It is actually being sold by the Tanners in Arizona today as if this passage was damning the church. Well, I think it's a very strong defense of Joseph Smith, because he's a realist. He recognizes the truth where he sees it, and he says, search your hearts and see if you're like God. I have searched mine. Fowling, that book, Fowling, you know, the diaries of Joseph Smith. That's being circulated as an anti-Mormon book now. I hope they circulate it far and wide, because it testifies to the absolute honesty of Joseph Smith. We have thieves among us, adulterers, liars, hypocrites. As far as we degenerate from God, we descend from the devil. We descend from the devil and lose knowledge. And without knowledge, we cannot be saved while our hearts are filled with evil. We are studying evil. There is no room in our hearts for good or studying good. The church must be cleansed, and I proclaim against all iniquity. A man is saved no faster than he gets knowledge. We know these passages. Hence, it needs revelation to assist us and give us knowledge. We are helpless otherwise. Ignorance, more of Joseph, ignorance, superstition, and bigotry, placing itself where it ought not, is oft times in the way of prosperity of the church. Why don't they circulate Brother Joseph Fielding's teachings of Joseph Smith as an anti-Mormon book? It has just as strong statements in it. What could he do about it? He didn't worry, since God was in charge. Notwithstanding, we are rolled in the mire for a time being. Next surge, peradventure, as time rolls on, may bring us to a fountain as clear as crystal and as pure as stone. That perfect confidence, he never panics, he never worries, as Edward Meyer said. He never shows a moment of doubt, as every other religious needer necessarily must. After that vision, he never showed any signs of doubting where it would end. Though Thomas B. Marsh was president of the 12, he was told, therefore, see to it that you trouble not yourselves concerning the affairs of my church in this place. That isn't your business, though he was president of the 12. He says, your business is to purify your hearts before me and then go into all the world and preach my gospel. This is the reaction of Heber C. Kimball when he visited Kirtland. After the debacle, he found it a bleak and doleful prospect. He said, but the faults of our brethren are poor entertainment for us. We have no accusation to bring, for the Lord has shown us that he has taken the matter into his own hands. During the past 2 weeks, a big item in national news was a couple of weeks ago, the phenomenal spread of religious scams throughout the country, and the beginnings are traced to Utah. So what else is new? Ever since Moroni told Joseph Smith that greedy men would be after the plates and that he too would be tempted, the problem of exploiting the church and the gospel has been with us. There have been frauds and secret abominations and evil works of darkness going on, this is Joseph speaking to the people, leading the minds of the weak and unwary into confusion and distraction, and all the time palming it off on the presidency. Where a crowd is flocking from all parts of the world of different minds, religions, and so forth, there will be some who do not live up to the commandments. There will be designing characters who would turn you aside and lead you astray, speculators who would get away your property. This is no new thing, you see. Therefore, it is necessary that we have an order here. The heads of the church are best qualified to advise. Many, when they arrived here, he says, are distracted with the conduct of some of the saints because everything was not done perfectly right, and they get mad, and thus the devil gets advantage over them to destroy them. But if they will bear with mine affirmities and with the affirmities of the brethren, I would likewise bear with their affirmities. That's an amusing thing that comes up here. Men whose questionable business projects he rebuked would go over and find allies among the mob. He was never safe a moment. Here's some interesting that just came in here. He says, he's giving a speech to a huge crowd of newly arrived immigrants that have just come in, very much impressed, and he ends his speech. At the end of the speech, he said, I told them it was likely I would have to hide up again in the woods, but they would not be discouraged. He'd come out of the woods to preach to them, now he had to run out and hide in the woods again. Now, that man's not going to get the big head, you see. And here he says again, the first presidency returned at evening, all sound and well. They were chased some 10 or 12 miles by some evil designing person, but escaped out of their hands. Now, such were the special privileges enjoyed by the president of the church and so forth, hiding out in the woods, being chased, the first presidency being chased 10 or 12 miles by a gang. What a business. And he said, here's Joseph again, he has said that he intended to do his duty before the Lord, and he hoped the brethren would be patient, as they had a considerable distance to go. Until we have perfect love, we are liable to fall. That God often sealed up the heavens because of covetousness in the church. It still goes on, you see. And except the church receive a fullness of the scriptures, they would yet fail. Is not this exactly the situation today? President Benson pleads with us to read the scriptures, and we gingerly pick our way through the Book of Mormon as if we were walking through a minefield instead of taking each passage to heart. What a trial it must have been for one who had conversed with angels and with the prophets of old to find himself surrounded by a bunch of yahoos who considered themselves very important. In the 1840s, important men swarmed on the frontier. Everybody was seemed to be a doctor, a natural doctor, a botanic doctor, they say, who either prescribed Calomel or Lobelia, those were the two medical schools. Or you were a general, someone who had mustered troops at some time or other. Or you were a judge, someone who'd read the law at some times. And Joseph Smith says, all ye doctors who are fools, stop your practice. All ye lawyers who have no business, only as you hatch it up. Would to God you would run away and go to work. would go to work or run away. But he was surrounded by such men. How could he get through to them? How could he expect them to react? He says, how vain and trifling have been our spirits, our conferences, our councils, our meetings, private as well as public conversations, too low, too mean, too vulgar, too condescending for the dignified characters of the called and chosen of God. But because people have faults, we do not rebuke them unless some good can come. But what we call constructive criticism, meaning approval, is not criticism of all. To be constructive, criticism must reach the person for whom it's meant, and of course he must have a chance to reply, but that's discussion, that isn't criticism. Those who rebuke the brethren, again Joseph, place themselves in the seat of Satan, who is emphatically called the accuser of his brethren. The word devil, diabolos, means simply accuser. There are many tales of how Satan goes before the Lord bringing accusations against his erring children. The interesting point of these old tales is that Satan does not make a false accusation. He doesn't need to with men behaving the way they do. It's for making real accusations that the Lord rebukes him and dismisses the devil from his presence. You can always count on the critics. False and wicked misrepresentations by members have caused thousands to think they were doing God's service when persecuting the Church of God. And that's from Joseph Smith again. The splinter group, a common phenomenon that began with the church itself, still flourishing. The leaders who go off by themselves to live the gospel in its purity as they think, have they discredited church and their cause by breaking the basic rule on which the church is founded, and this is quoting again, there is no man who has the liberty to lead away people into the wilderness. There have been many such defections. They're still going on. They're always based on someone's personal revelation, completely ignoring the basic principle, quote again, no person through discernment of spirits can bring a charge against another. That must be proven guilty by positive evidence or they stand clear. Let no one presume to say this or that general authority has fallen or anything else. Anyway, no man is capable of judging the matter in counsel unless his own heart is pure. We frequently are so filled with prejudice or have a beam in our own eye that we are not capable of passing the right decision. This is all Joseph Smith. I get no credit. Any man, before he makes an objection to any item, should be sure that he can throw light on the subject rather than spread darkness. Joseph set forth to the people the evils that existed and would exist by reason of hasty judgment upon any subject given by the people or in judging before they had heard both sides of the question. If I esteem mankind to be in error, he says, shall I bear them down? No, I will lift them up. And each in his own way, if I cannot persuade him my way, is better. And I will ask no man to believe as I do. No matter what the provocation, let the elders be exceedingly careful about unnecessarily disturbing and harrowing up the feelings about the people. Avoid contentions and all vain disputations with men of corrupt minds who do not desire to know the truth. If they receive not your testimony in one place, flee to another, remembering to cast no reflection nor throw out any bitter sayings. The kingdom alone. The Lord steadies the ark. If it does jostle and appear to need steadying, if the way is a little sidelong sometimes to all appearances, threatens its overthrow, be careful how you stretch forth your hands to steady it. Let us not be too officious in meddling with that which does not concern us. Let it alone. It's the Lord's work. I know well enough to let the kingdom alone and do my duty. It carries me. I do not carry the kingdom. That's an interesting thing, that people who do this do not want to be excommunicated. They'd lose their clout with the Gentiles if they were not members of the church. And, of course, as excommunicated, they wouldn't carry much weight in the church anyway. He says, many who have left this church have tried the experiment of building up the kingdom of God by their learning, saying, when we have established our church, it will then be the kingdom of the Lord. So what do you do if you see folly and error all around you? You continue to think for yourself. That's the first rule. And that means to think to yourself. Thought is an inner process. It never reaches finality. No theory can ever be proven, says Hawking, the eminent citizens of our time. Joseph says, we build our own kingdoms and obtain by our own faithfulness our own crowns that will exactly fit us. So it is with Brother Joseph's advice on the subject. Let us be faithful and silent, brethren. And if God gives you a manifestation, keep it to yourself. Do not watch for iniquity in each other. If you do, you will not get an endowment, for God will not bestow it on such. In an organization made up so largely of nonconformists, conflicts were inevitable, and the leader told them this was one of the ways in which they were being tested. His personal presence we have not. Therefore, we have a need of greater faith. And I am determined to do all I can to uphold you, although I may do many things inadvertently that are not right in the sight of God. Within the church itself, said Joseph, the adversary is bringing into requisition all his subtlety to prevent the saints from being endowed by causing division among the 12, also among the 70, and bickerings and jealousy among the elders and the official members of the church. So he covenanted with the 12, he says, not to listen to nor credit any derogatory report against any of you, nor condemn you upon any testimony beneath heaven short of that testimony which is infallible. I can see you face to face and know of it assuredly, and I ask the same of you. Character peculiar of Joseph Smith also is to love and esteem people deeply and at the same time be perfectly aware of all their terrible faults. Examples here, for example. Well, he says, brethren, I am not a very pious man. I do not wish to be a great deal better than anybody else. If a prophet was so much better than anyone else, he would inherit a glory far beyond that of anyone else would inherit. Behold, he'd be all alone, for who would be his company in heaven, he says. Then he says, righteousness is not that which men esteem holiness. That which the world calls righteousness, I have not any regard for. To be righteous is to be just and merciful. If a man fails in kindness, justice, and mercy, he will be damned. And a book by one of his worst enemies said, Joseph never said an unkind thing about anyone. He gives examples of Brother Sidney. Remember, he says, he's a man I love, but in his terrible faults, and after Joseph protested, he'd spread darkness rather than light in the conference by a vote of the church, restored him without further confession. Joseph took him back and said, nevertheless, he is a very great and good man. The same thing. Reynolds Calhoun, Robert Matthias, and so forth. And that a typical example, here is in his two successive days in his journal. One day he prayed that the Lord would grant that Brother Joseph Smith might prevail over his enemies, even Dr. Philastus Hurlbut, who has threatened his life. The very next day, quote, Dr. Hurlbut came to my house. He was ordained to the office of an elder in the church. I heard him say that if he ever became convinced that the Book of Mormon was false, he would be the cause of my destruction. And he tried to prove that the rest of his life, the false affidavits and so forth. But notice, he always gives the enemy, the other person, the benefit of the doubt. How could he meet such depravity with such, well, the case of his brother William and so forth, and other cases. Now, this is one point before I could go to add this. The main object of jealousy and rivalry in organizations is rank and office. Let the 12 be humble and not be exalted. Beware of pride and not seek to excel one above another, but act for each other's good and honorably make mention of each other's name in our prayers before the Lord and before our fellow men. Do not devour and backbite our brother. Must the moons that are chosen to fill the places of those that have fallen of the quorum of the 12 begin to exalt themselves until they get so high they will tumble over and have a great fall and go wallowing through the mud and mire, darkness, Judas-like, to the buffetings of Satan, as several of the 12 have done? He says, ever since the commencement of this work, he had to surmount difficulties in consequence of aspiring men. Great big elders, he called them, who caused him much trouble. He said he had been trampled underfoot by aspiring elders, for all were infected with that spirit. He said he had a subtle devil to deal with and could only curb it by being humble. Though, you know, quoting him again, those who want high office are like their brother the devil, precisely the high seats on the stand. Why do they take that seriously? What nonsense, he says. He spoke of the disposition of many men to consider lower offices in the church dishonorable and to look with jealous eyes upon the standing of those who were called to preside over them. It was folly and nonsense of the human heart for a person to be aspiring to other stations than those which they were appointed by God for them to occupy. Of course, it says in 104th and such, the head cannot say to the foot, I have no need of thee. Many already have been ordained. Well, this is Joseph. As natural as this personal ambition is the tendency to form exclusive groups and cliques as bestowing prestige and influence. Concerning my brethren, Joseph again, be not partial toward them in love above many others, but let thy love abound to all men and to all who love my name. Personal feelings of friendship and association ought to sink into comparative insignificance and have no weight in view of the consequences so momentous to the people of the kingdom of God. Hence, the advancement for the cause of God and the building of Zion is as much one man's business as another. Party feelings, separate interests, exclusive designs should be lost sight of in the one common cause in the interest of the whole. He did his best to invest the brethren with his own magnanimous spirit. President Smith addressed the 12 against self-sufficiency, self-righteousness, self-importance, but especially teaching them to observe charity, wisdom, fellow feeling with love one toward another in all things and circumstances. But all men are not alike in stature, temperament, or endowment. That's why the Lord in the Revelations lays such emphasis on gifts. It's through the various gifts distributed among us that we are able to get into the act. In the 42nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, we are told repeatedly both to ask for gifts and seek for the gifts. Almost in the last words of the Book of Mormon, do not deny the gifts, do not reject the gifts. On the other hand, we are commanded not to ask for or seek for office. Yet nobody seems particularly interested in asking or seeking for gifts, while men constantly plan, scheme, and aspire to office. Martin Harris and the others actually left the church because their services were not recognized by high office. Well, just let me talk to Moroni face to face for 5 minutes, and I'll give you the pleasure of sitting on the stand forevermore. The man who got the gift like that had the privilege of standing in the presence of the angel and having turned over the plates. Then he wanted an office in the church, temporary, a nuisance, meaning nothing. Why this craving for office? Because office necessarily has high profile and prestige. High seats in the synagogue are attended on what Shakespeare calls the insolence of office. Gifts, on the other hand, are secret and private. And Joseph says, the greatest, the best, and the most useful gifts would be known nothing about by anybody but yourself. But yet it's the gift you should want. Now, an observer, he says, what does the world know about prophesying? He tells us that our gifts are to be put to the use, the 46th section, our gifts are to be put to the use, the church, as part of a mix. They are distributed and balanced among the members, and that's why the church, with a crew of pushy and assertive people, always sails with an even keel. Plots to bring it to sudden and brilliant worldly success have been matched by equally ambitious schemes to bring it to complete halt, to accomplish quick disillusion. But what Brigham Young calls the good ship Zion has sailed on and completely disregarded both, has neither exploded in growth nor collapsed in disillusionment. While it is the privilege of every elder to speak of the things of God, said Joseph, God calls or elects particular men for particular works on whom to confer special blessings. He's aware of their defects. If my blessings are not your blessings, my curses are not your curses. So if you think any of the brethren seems to be under-endowed in any particular gift or knowledge, know that God has chosen that one for other gifts, and he will endow him with the gifts he needs as occasion arises. How often have we seen quite ordinary men called to responsibility in the church suddenly grow to stature almost beyond recognition? They become giants, so to speak. Well, all this by way of considering criticism of the brethren by some of the intellectuals and so forth. Well, this is true, you see. The critics have always been right about that, our lack of intellectual, artistic, and literary savvy in the church. They have been right. We always have treasured the trash and trashed the treasures in the church, the BY. Brigham Young says, I could weep like a whipped child when I see what fools the Latter-day Saints make of them. They throw away all their blessings and they accept all this garbage. Joseph Smith, for example, was an impassioned scholar. You know, he hungered for learning. He reveled in it when he had a chance. And never tired of showing and explaining the papyri to visitors. His own curiosity was the most lively of all. Typical, I spent a day in translating Egyptian records. Cowdery returned from New York, bearing with him a quantity of Hebrew books for the benefit of the school. He presented me with a Hebrew Bible, a lexicon, and a grammar, also a Greek lexicon and Webster's lexicon. He threw himself with a passion into the study of ancient Hebrew writings. The new book will show you that. Through the year 1835, he made great progress, especially in Hebrew. It would be easy to underestimate his progress, actually. By the end of the year, I'm sure, he certainly would have qualified for graduate study in Hebrew. He knew much more about it than we credit him with. And what Joseph Smith had good advice for scholars. He said, I discovered in this debate they had too much zeal for mastery, too much of that enthusiasm that characterizes a lawyer at the bar determined to defend his cause right or wrong. I advised them that they might improve their minds and cultivate their intellects in a proper manner. See, the critics were really just showing off, and that's what we do in sessions like this. The next day, he said, he organized the School of the Prophets as a direct result of the manuscript find. Spent the day in endeavoring to treasure up knowledge for the benefit of my colleagues. Oh, may God give me learning, even language, to endow me with the qualifications. I magnify his name while I live. The next day, at home studying the Greek language. In the afternoon, visited relatives of Cowdery and so forth who were obnubilists. He found them to be. Why have we not followed Joseph Smith's lead in this search for learning? Well, our naivete has brought the church into embarrassing situations from time to time. But this is where the gifts are very important. The church is a school in which all take the same basic courses. All are free then to branch out into specialties which are important and necessary for some to pursue, lest we lose by default when we're noisily attacking some directions. Joseph, had he lived, might have been a specialist. He says, "My soul delights in reading the word of the Lord in the original. I am determined to pursue the study of languages until I shall become master of them, if I am permitted to live long enough." Always that if, he knew it. He made allowance for other plans, and the Lord had other plans for him. Had the brethren followed that line of study, for example, that so fascinated him, we would be up to our ears today in hair-splitting discussions and recondite speculation. The brethren have their work cut out for them, and strenuous work it is. It calls for studying the gospel to see to it that the greatest possible number of people in all parts of the world get to hear the first principles. This requires constant repetitions of first principles to fresh audiences wherever the authorities go. They can't be expected to set forth advanced ideas or frontline research. This poses a dilemma, for no men are more in touch with the developments in various fields where the church might be benefited. On my first day in Provo, President Joseph Fielding Smith was having lunch with the Royal Robertses down at Edna May's. You remember where old Edna May's used to be. And during the lunch, Joseph Fielding made a remark I will never forget. He says, "We are rapidly coming to be known as a mediocre people. Since then, we have made giant strides in that direction." But whose fault is that? Yes. That very same first week, a little later in the week, I had a meeting with some of the faculty. It's my first there. Some of them complained of the mediocrity of literature and art, the Harry Anderson School in the church. I took the liberty to point out to the speaker, one of the most eminent on the faculty, that the brethren would have no objection at all to his writing an immortal drama or poem or even the great American novel. In fact, nothing would delight them more than to have the present company produce an outpouring of those masterpieces whose absence they so deplored. They, not the brethren, were responsible for the famine. That's rather surprising. They'd not thought about it that way, but the knee-jerk reaction is, when upset, blame the brethren. Well, Joseph Smith retained his sanity by dealing with the situation in high good humor. We have some examples here. Don't be limited in your views with regard to your neighbor's virtue, but beware of self-righteousness. Be limited in estimate of your own virtue. You must enlarge your souls towards each other. We must bear each other's failings as indulgent parent buries the foibles of his children. There you are. You see, we're at the school. We must be allowed to make mistakes at the school, to say that there are mistakes in the essays and reports that are handed in, therefore we'll disband the school. Well, that's mistakes. That's the whole point of it. See, we're here to get out the nitty-gritty and find out where we're weak and why we're strong, and this is our practice preparing for the long pull ahead hereafter. All overriding all else is that ground feeling of love which makes life a joy, and everything I read about Joseph Smith reflects that. He says, "I see no fault in the church." After all, he says, "Let me be resurrected with the saints, whether to heaven or hell or any." See, it's the church taken as a whole, the way the thing stands right now, you see. A particular fault is this, that, or the other, you see. But it's like the... he goes on to explain what he means. A good society, what do we care if the society is good? Friendship is the grand fundamental principle of Mormonism, to revolutionize and civilize the world. Pour forth love. Do not dwell upon your fault. I do not, and you shall not dwell upon mine. If Presbyterians have any truth, embrace that. Baptists, Methodists, and so forth, get all the good in the world, come out a pure Mormon. Then he gives a good description of our world again when he says, "The only polish I get is when some corner gets rubbed off by coming in contact with someone else. Something else striking with accelerated force against religious bigotry, priestcraft, lawyercraft, doctorcraft, lying editors, suborned judges and jurors, the authority of perjured executives backed by mobs, blasphemers, licentious and corrupt men and women, all hell knocking a corner off here and there." Well, now, isn't that our society today? But yet, note well what follows. Ha-ha. "Yet it is with difficulty that I can keep from complaining and murmuring against this, but I am sensible that this is not right." See, after, you know, nobody had better reason for knowing what was going on, because he was the object. All the brickbats were coming his way, but he wants to murmur, but he says, "I am sensible that this is not right. The power over the minds of mankind which I hold is the power of truth in doctrine. I ask, did I ever exercise any compulsion over any man? Did I not give him the liberty to disbelieve any doctrine I have preached if he saw fit? Why do not my enemies strike a blow at the doctrine? They cannot do it. It is truth." Joseph again spoke and showed that his power was in doctrine, and he defied all men to upset that. Well, then there's lots more. The final key that Willard Richards delivered here, He says, I will give you one of the keys of the mysteries of the kingdom. The final key delivered to Joseph Smith was this. It's an eternal principle that existed with God from all eternity. That if a man tries to rise up and condemn others, finding fault with the church, he condemns the whole system because of this flaw or that. See, that's what it amounts to. The church, saying that they are out of the way while he himself is righteous, then know assuredly that that man is on the high road to apostasy. If he does not repent, he will apostatize as God lives. Well, you might say that person has already apostatized if he doesn't trust God to know what he is doing. But they don't think of it that way. They want to be in the church, as I mentioned before. And then a meeting was held to discuss these things with Joseph. A very interesting thing. A body of such people came together to contend when there had been lots of people breaking off and so forth. His speech was this. These things are too trivial a nature to occupy the attention of so large a body. I intend to give you some instruction in the principles of eternal truth. Those who feel desirous of sowing seeds of discord will be disappointed on this occasion. It is our purpose to build up and establish the principles of righteousness and not break down and destroy. The Prince William E. McClellan is typical. He said, quote, that he had no confidence in the leaders of the church, believing that they had transgressed. Consequently, he left off praying. Had he been praying to them? And indulged himself in lustful desires. So that's what he wanted to do all along, you see, to show his disapproval of them. Oh, foolish man, says Joseph, because thou hast heard of some man's transgression, that thou shouldst leave thy God and forsake thy prayers. It's always been the familiar scenario in the church, people using perceived imperfections of the church as a pretext for them to relax their own personal moral standards. Well, this is the recommendation, and the psychologists and our own experience tell us that it can be disastrous to keep our feelings and emotions bottled up too tight. It can lead to an explosion. So what should we do? Be like the importunate widow and complain. Go all the way. Itemize your griefs, your doctrinal objections, your personal distastes. Lay them all out in full detail and get it out of your system. You may wonder why people see me talking so much to myself. With this understanding that you will do all this before the only person who is qualified to judge either you or your tormentors. As you bring your complaints, be fully aware that he knows everything already, including everything there is to know about you. I must mention reverse criticism here. That's flattery, which flourishes in our society. When I flatter someone, I'm telling him that he's better than I really think he is to get on his good side. You can see that there's a cynical twist to that. It's opportunistic. Actually, I'm snidely mocking the guy, manipulating him in my interests. Well, now, I end with this admonition against flattery, lest I be accused of it when I say that I cannot imagine a body of men less likely to go astray or to lead anyone else astray than the present leaders of the church. When I first came to the BYU, the division of religion was small, and under Wilkinson's plan to send a faculty out to state conferences with the brethren to recruit students for the school, I had the privilege of making a number of visits with a number of general authorities, quite a few of them, Dilworth Young, Martin Luther, and so forth. How they worked. Lifelong assignments for them, living in a goldfish bowl, everlastingly meeting appointments and carrying out routine duties. True, there is nothing like the joy of doing the Lord's work, but anyone can have that privilege any time. Don't envy them that. I spent a week with Apostle Kimball, visiting his home state in Arizona. We've gone 10 days. We went by train in those early days. We came back to Los Angeles, the old Los Angeles station there. And in that part of Los Angeles, there are a lot of bookstores, which I knew very well. And I ran off, and I bought a whole set, a very rare collection, of Molinos, the 17th century Jesuit writer on probabilism. It's a very valuable 10 volumes. And I barely made it back to the train by running across a lot and jumped on the train and got in, plumped down beside Brother Kimball, and he was on the train. And I staggered into the drawing room with my arms full of a complete set of Molinos' work on probabilism, which I greatly valued. As we sat talking about the books, Brother Kimball casually took an immaculate linen handkerchief from his breast pocket of his jacket and, stooping over, vigorously dusted off my shoes and trousers. It was the most natural thing in the world, and we both took it completely for granted. After all, my shoes had to get dusty in the race for the train, and Brother Kimball had always told missionaries to keep themselves clean and proper. It was no great thing, pas d'histoire. And neither of us said a thing about it. But ever since, that has conditioned my attitude to the brethren. I truly believe they are the chosen servants of God. Thank you, brother. Mm-hmm.
We'd like to close the symposium by singing "The Spirit of God Like a Fire is Burning."